Welcome to the weekly podcast from the Church of England. In a moment, news of BP's shareholders approving a motion to improve their record on climate change. Also in the programme, we hear why a group of chaplains have been meeting this week and how you can vote on your favourite religious television programme in a Radio Times poll. But first, shareholders at BP have voted overwhelmingly in favour of a resolution on climate change, put forward by a group which included the Church of England. It called for the company to have a greater commitment to moving to a low-carbon economy. The church commissioners from the Church of England are part of an investor coalition called Aiming for A. They've welcomed the overwhelming result for the motion, which was recommended for support by the company's board. I'm joined by Edward Mason, the head of responsible investment at the Church of England. Edward, you must be delighted at this news.
I'm absolutely delighted. I'm still getting used to it, actually. Yesterday was a remarkable day. We had a shareholder resolution filed by a Church of England fund manager, CCLA, and strongly supported by the Church Commissioners and the Church of England Pensions Board, that was passed with 98% of the vote at BP's AGM on climate change. It's a really, really unprecedented development to have the AGM of a major oil company dominated in this way by climate change. And it's a real step change in institutional investors' engagement with the oil and gas industry on the challenge of the energy transition.
What's it going to mean practically? What are BP going to have to do now?
Well, what we were asking for was improved disclosure on a wide range of climate change issues. So real detailed disclosure from BP on issues like how they're managing their own carbon emissions, how they're investing in the right kind of projects for the energy future that we're facing, how they're incentivizing executives, how they're engaging in public policy lobbying. So this information will give investors a really rich and deep set of information on how BP is adapting itself to the challenge of climate change, and will enable investors to have a real step change in their relationship with the company on the challenge of the long-term energy transition. I guess you could say it gives climate change a permanent seat at the board table.
Are you confident that it will give you that insight now as shareholders into what they're doing?
Absolutely, I am. I mean, this is not a one-off thing. It's part of a process. So we've been engaging with BP for years. I mean, this shareholder resolution is the culmination of 3 years of engagement with the company, and that doesn't stop. This resolution is just part of the process of getting the information, the relationship on climate change that we and other investors need. As I say, this was supported by 98% of the shareholders voting at the resolution. This is mainstream institutional investors. The day before the vote, we had a declaration from the largest sovereign wealth fund in the world, the Norwegian Pension Fund, in support of the resolution. So these are extremely serious investors that will be talking to BP in the years ahead about the energy transition.
These are potentially tricky subjects. You're talking about oil companies looking at climate change. That's sometimes an uneasy relationship. But where do you go from here now? I mean, do you consider that your work is done and this is fine and you're happy with this?
No, not at all. I mean, we're in this for the long haul. And everyone has to be in this for the long haul. Climate change is a hugely challenging problem. And it's not just the problem of any one party like an oil company. It's the problem of investors, of individuals, of governments. And we all need to work together to make progress. This resolution was about BP doing its bit. It's also about investors doing their bit. And we all need to do a lot of further work in the years ahead. And the Church Commissioners are absolutely committed to doing that.
And Edward has been blogging about the topic. You can find it by going to the front page of our website, www.churchofengland.org. From airports to shopping centres, chaplains can be found in hundreds of locations across the country. This week they've been meeting to discuss their work. I caught up with Gary Neave, who's the Church of England's National Advisor on Further Education and Post-16 Institutions, and also a chaplain himself, to find out more.
We're looking at two main things, one of which is, why is it that chaplaincy matters, both in terms of what sorts of things do chaplains do and why ought that to matter to schools, colleges, retail centres, airports, hospitals? And secondly, what do we need to say to the church about why chaplaincy matters? And so for the church, the Church of England itself needs to work out, why does chaplaincy matter and what can it better do to support that work?
Why do you think it matters? What does it offer people?
A chance to look at the values and beliefs that drive their lives, to be challenged to think about them in an open-minded way, to understand what faith and belief can bring and also what difficulties they raise, and to have somewhere to explore the most important questions that, in my experience at least, people are bursting to do if you give them half a chance.
Do you think people would be surprised at the number and range of chaplains? You've already mentioned shopping centres, airports and schools, which is a really broad range that may surprise some people.
Yeah, I think it probably would. If your image of a chaplain is, say, a traditional army padre or somebody in a black clerical shirt who appears at a hospital bedside, then probably people might be surprised to know that there are chaplains working in waterways. There are chaplains working with groups who work with women who faced abuse. They are in hospitals and schools and the fire service and the police and the armed forces, a whole bunch of other groups. So I think people would be surprised. From the church point of view, there isn't anywhere that we don't have the privilege and responsibility of offering help and support. Our national tradition in this country is that public life involves the engagement with faith and belief. No longer one faith or one set of beliefs, and that's a good thing, but that we don't sharply split off our public lives from the beliefs we hold about the world and our place in it. And if that's true, we need to have people of faith working in those organisations.
When you're in these institutions, though, presumably not everybody has a faith, so do you work there for everybody?
Yeah, the whole point about being a chaplain is that you're there for people of all faiths and beliefs, whether that belief system is religiously based, whether it's based on humanist or other principles. You are there to serve the whole community, not simply the people who happen to belong to your church or religion or faith.
Have you got an example of when that might have happened in your work? Because you work in further education.
That's right, and have been a chaplain to a large FE college. It's a difficult and sometimes painful area to remember. But some years ago, we had five students who were all killed in a road accident. Their car left the road at high speed, and all five of them, all young people, all just finished their exams, were killed in the accident. And people turned to the chaplaincy because it was a natural place for them to come to want to think, to mourn, to cry, to celebrate the good things that they remembered about their friends. The accident had a huge effect on the staff who taught all these students. They were completely devastated. It was an area where parents and friends and employers could come. And I had the difficult privilege of conducting five different sets of funerals, one of which involved parents of Chinese heritage who had a Buddhist belief system, which the local Anglican parish church hosted because it was the natural and obvious place for people to turn.
Gary Neave talking about the work of chaplains. Finally this week, details on how you can vote for your favourite religious programme in a Radio Times poll. It's part of the Reader's Award for Faith Programming in the annual Sanford St Martin Trust Awards for Religious Broadcasting. On the shortlist this year are television programmes Rev, BBC One's Canterbury Cathedral, Messiah at the Foundling Hospital, which ran on BBC Two, Songs of Praise, the Gospel Choir of the Year, Lent Diaries for Channel 4 and Grantchester on ITV. I spoke to Tom Loxley, who's the executive editor of the Radio Times.
Our readers are by nature very engaged with stuff, and one of the things they do engage with is religion. But we've found that far from just pigeonholing the obvious religious programming having a dedicated awards like this could do, it's actually encouraged people to think more broadly about what counts as a religious programme. So programmes which have at their heart, the human condition, such as Rev, have actually qualified, and it's not simply because the lead character wears a dog collar.
In the past, who have been winners?
Rev has actually been on the shortlist before. It hasn't won. It certainly received a lot of support. Last year's winner was Simon Sharma's History of the Jews, which was a terrific series that our readers really enjoyed. The year before that, David Suchet produced a one-off documentary in the footsteps of St. Paul, which was a winner. And again, I think that won not just because David Suchet is much loved as Inspector Poirot, but actually because it was a documentary that that encouraged people to think about the Bible as history, and also about biblical history as it and its resonance today. So, so those have been two of the more recent winners. But as I say, it'll be interesting to see what happens this year with more variety on the shortlist.
Obviously, in your role, you're looking at all sorts of television, documentaries, soaps, everything that's made. What role do you think religious programming has got to play within the wide genre of what's on television?
Well, I think it's interesting because what counts as religious broadcasting is quite a big debate, and I'm not sure that actually the awards are there to, as I said before, really, they're not there to sort of pigeonhole or define religious broadcasting too closely. I think what they're really saying is that there are strands in these programmes which actually resonate with the way religion looks at the world.
The Right Reverend Nick Baines is the chair of the Sanford St. Martin Trust, which promotes programming that deals with religion, ethics and spirituality. I started by asking him whether religious broadcasting is in a good state.
Contrary to the prejudices of some people, including in the industry, religious broadcasting, not just broadcasting on religious themes, but about life and people, of course, is very strong. And what you find is that on the shortlists that are drawn up, you find stories about real human life, ethics, religion, what motivates people to live the way they do and make decisions the way they do, and so on. And a lot of that is picked up in story, in documentary, and so on. Great interest in it.
Now, if you look at the shortlist, it does range from drama to documentary, music in there. I mean, that really shows, doesn't it, that there is such a breadth of broadcasting with a religious theme.
Well, I think one of the prejudices out there is that, in some quarters, is that if you use the words religious broadcasting, what you mean is we want more songs of praise. Now, when you look at the shortlist this time, you've got sitcom, effectively, in Rev. You've got a documentary on Canterbury Cathedral, which, you know, might sound dry as dust until you watch it. You think, actually, this is about history, it's about communities, it's about politics, it's about religion, it's about, a particular place, about architecture. There's everything in here. And, you know, religion is not simply about ideas that people either simply accept or reject. It's about what motivates people, drives people, both as individuals and communities. The great thing about the Radio Times Readers Award is that it's people out in the wide public who are voting for what they have really liked, really enjoyed, really benefited from. And so, I mean, how do you choose between Rev, Grantchester on ITV, Canterbury Cathedral, Lent Diaries on Channel 4, Gospel Choir of the Year on BBC One, I mean, the Messiah from the Foundling Hospital, BBC Two. I mean, it's a wide range of material, but the thing that holds them together is that they are really excellent examples of broadcasting, and they will hold their own. And we'll have to see what the public thinks.
And you can vote by going to the Radio Times website, which is www.radiotimes.com. That's it for this week's podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Gillian Moody.